My name is Jackie Lamport. Today is Wednesday, March 3rd. Welcome to the Capital Daily Podcast. Today on the show.
Canada's immunization rollout right now is comparatively equal to where Israel was back in late December, so we're definitely playing some catch up here.
Israel has reached the milestone of having given at least one dose of vaccinations to over 50% of their population. Now, they're starting to reopen their economy. We look at where Canada is in comparison and what we've learned that could shape our eventual reopening. Today's Capital Daily Podcast is brought to you by Community Plus.
I'm just going to quickly talk about phase three and phase four, which as we look ahead to the rest of our population, we know it's going to change. So just right up front, we've just had this news of AstraZeneca at the very end of the week, not quite sure the exact volumes. And then, as Dr. Henry said, the extension of dose two will make a big, big difference to our ability to vaccinate our mass population. It will effectively, when we modeled it last night, it will likely result in by mid to late July that we will have been able to give a first dose to everybody in our population, which is a significant shift from our earlier plan out into September.
That's British Columbia's new vaccination goal. The country as a whole has lagged behind our close allies of the United States, the United Kingdom, the European Union, and a whole host of other countries. Among those is the country that has grabbed the attention worldwide for being so quickly to vaccinate. Israel. Israel has now hit the milestone of the majority of their population having received at least one dose of the vaccination, and about 37% of the population have also received the second dose. Research coming from the country's largest healthcare provider shows a 94% drop in symptomatic COVID-19 infections among 600,000 people who received two doses of Pfizer's vaccine. Now, the country is shifting their focus to reopening their economy. The country has become a beacon of hope. With that success on display to the world, other countries, including Canada, are looking at what they did right and what strategies we can adopt. Monday brought good news to British Columbians who were hoping to speed up our own vaccinations. The province announced that we are entering phase two of the vaccination schedule, and as you heard, have moved the goalposts of administering at least one dose to all adult citizens to the end of July. My colleague Rishdi Basu published an article on this just moments after the information from the province came out. Rishdi, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Jackie.
So Monday, what did we learn Monday that was new?
Yeah, so Monday morning, we got lots of new information from the BC Ministry of Health. The biggest thing, I think, is that based on a couple of new key factors, everyone above the age of 18 in BC is going to be able to get at least one dose of the vaccine by the end of July, compared to earlier timelines that projected that we'd reach that milestone by September. So this pushes the schedule forward by like 2 months. And so the two main factors that is kind of leading to this push is, first of all, the AstraZeneca vaccine approval. BC now kind of expects to get about 60,000 doses sometime next week. And the plan there is to launch kind of a parallel vaccination campaign that targets essential populations like first responders and like poultry plant workers, grocery store workers, people under the age of 65 that are essential, who can then choose to get the AstraZeneca vaccine when it's out, or they could wait for the other two vaccines to become available based on their age. And then the second factor that pushes the milestone up to July is that the province is actually delaying second doses of the vaccine to 4 months after the first dose. And this is based on data from BC and from other jurisdictions that shows that after just one dose, the vaccine is 90% effective against COVID-19, and that effectiveness lasts for at least 4 months. So, I mean, that was the biggest thing that we learned. But of course, another big part of the update this morning, on Monday morning, was announcing when and how people over the age of 18 can start getting their first doses. So now we know that for this stage of the rollout, each health authority is going to have a unique phone line for people and their loved ones to call starting March 8th. And then they can book the appointments for vaccines starting March 15th. And then after that phase, the next phase of the rollout will focus on people aged over 75. And at that point, they'll be introducing a new online registration tool and a single provincial phone line. But we don't know much about that system yet.
Mm-hmm. I saw in when you were doing your research and I was reading through, you were kind of citing Alberta as a little bit of a mistake when it came to their phone lines. I guess BC is learning from that.
Yeah. So basically what happened in Alberta is that they launched a system where it was online and a phone line where everyone over the age of 75 was told that they could call in or go online to book an appointment on the first day of the launch. And then what happened was that even though the population in Alberta above the age of 75 is about 175,000 people, they got like 2 million calls when the booking system first launched. So what BC is trying to do is they're further staggering when people can call to book an appointment based on age. So on March 8th, seniors above the age of 90 and then Indigenous people older than 65 can book an appointment. And then on March 15th, seniors older than 85 can call, and people between 80 and 85 years old can only call on March 22nd or after. But it remains to be seen whether people in BC are actually going to follow that eligibility rule and wait for their turn. So we don't really know that yet.
I know that the province and the country as a whole has kind of been a little bit back and forth about, oh, we're on track. Oh, there's some slight delays. Okay, we're on track now. Given the tone of the message Monday, did it sound like BC is pretty confident that we're actually going to meet our timeline?
They're actually very confident now. I think it's based on what we've seen over the past 2 weeks where the supply chain has been fairly steady. But you're right, we have seen a lot of supply delays over the past month or two, and that's because Canada doesn't have an in-house manufacturer. And that's something that Premier Horgan brought up on Monday as well. He mentioned that there may still be hiccups in supply chains down the road, but for now it seems to be holding steady, and Dr. Bonnie Henry and Dr. Penny Ballam seem to be fairly confident that we're going to reach our targets.
Let's look a little bit at Israel, because that's kind of been the beacon for the rest of the world right now. They're just so far ahead. When we compare to Israel, where are we in that timeline?
So yeah, Israel is definitely way ahead of the curve on a global scale. They've already fully immunized about a third of their population, and more than half of the population has had at least one dose. Canada's immunization rollout right now is comparatively equal to where Israel was back in late December. So we're definitely playing some catch up here.
So also speaking of Israel, there was a COVID-19 advisory group from Ontario, and they published a study at the beginning of February that was showing what Israel did right and what Canada can maybe take from that. What did they find?
Yeah, so the group called Science Table, they were looking for lessons that they could apply to the rollout of the immunization program in Ontario, and they found six key takeaways that they could have learned from what Israel did. And that includes using age as the only factor to determine who gets the vaccine first, with exceptions for healthcare providers and first responders. The second point was transporting the Pfizer vaccine in smaller shipments to rural settings. Third was using communication strategies like endorsements from public health leaders and the premier to promote confidence in the vaccine. Fourth is creating a decentralized pop-up and drive-through immunization clinic network that would then supplement hospitals and pharmacy chains in delivering the vaccine. And then they also need to build a streamlined IT system that actually makes it easy for people to book and follow up on their vaccine appointments. And the last point is allowing community-based nurses, physicians, trained emergency medical technicians, and paramedics to administer the vaccine to kind of increase the number of people the number of staff that is doing that on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we saw the province announced that they would be allowing different medical professionals, such as dentists, to administer the vaccines. Other than that one, is there, to your knowledge, is BC looking at following any of these findings?
Yeah, BC is actually following the majority of these findings while working with a smaller, more variable, less predictable vaccine supply than Israel. One of the major differences, the exception, as outlined in the plan that was unveiled on Monday, is that BC is creating that parallel vaccine program with the AstraZeneca doses. So at that point, once that is launched, they're not only going to be looking at age, they're also going to be looking at priority populations like first responders. And that's something that Israel did not do.
And what are some of the other reasons that Canada might have a process that kind of differs from Israel?
So Canada's vaccine rollout was pretty slow to start, and based on a study published in the Israel Journal of Health Policy in January, partly the reason why is because the country has a very large geographical area and low population density compared to Israel. which means that they needed to create more storage facilities, invest in more transportation, and have more vaccination sites than Israel needed. And also in Canada, most hospitals and doctors operate independently rather than as part of integrated systems of care like in Israel. So that would make it more difficult to communicate and synchronize all the procedures.
Interesting. Now, Brishti, you've been kind of on top of the COVID story in British Columbia and Canada. You follow every update, you're tweeting about it, and you're writing the stories on it. From your own point of view, does this feel like something is actually going to be, that's going to pick up momentum?
I'm cautiously optimistic. I know that's something that Dr. Bonnie Henry says a lot, but I think it still remains to be seen because, as we talked about earlier, there have been hiccups in the vaccine supply chain. So the reliability of that is not guaranteed 100%. But at the same time, the fact that we have AstraZeneca doses on the way and just an updated timeline for when people are going to get vaccinated, I'm feeling pretty hopeful as a young person myself and as someone who knows other young people that would like to get vaccinated sooner than September. The July deadline seems a lot more promising. Yeah.
You think you're going to get vaccinated? I'm hoping I'm going to get vaccinated by July. That'd be very nice.
I hope so too.
Brishti, thank you so much. I will no doubt go to you, whether it be having you on or stealing your research for future episodes. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Jackie.
To read Brishti Basu's full breakdown of the announcement Monday and some comparison with other jurisdictions, visit capitaldaily.ca. Today's Capital Daily podcast is brought to you by Community Plus. Community Plus provides skilled, reliable, and friendly home health services across Greater Victoria, from caregiving to foot care to physiotherapy. They have 1 hour to 24-hour services available. It's your home, but it's their community of care. Find them at communitypluscare.ca. That's communitypluscare.ca. Do you want to help support Capital Daily's local journalism and connect your business with our engaged and curious Greater Victoria audience of almost 50,000? Email our partnerships team at advertising@capitaldaily.ca. Learning from Israel may be incredibly helpful for Canada and other countries as we move forward with vaccinations and reopening. But it remains to be seen whether or not being early out of the gate will be a large advantage. My next guest assured me that the mere months of difference shouldn't hinder our own success at re-entering the global economy at full capacity. She also spoke about the different advantages and disadvantages Canada has economically and how that will differ our reopening from other countries such as Israel. Iglika Ivanova is a senior economist for the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives. Iglika, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on the show.
So first, we were kind of looking toward Israel's future as a case study for Canada. But how similar or different is Canada's economy with Israel's?
Well, Canada's economy is very different. I think we have a fairly large resource sector here, and that presents certain constraints. As well, we rely a lot on tourism, especially in some regions like BC, and those have been very heavily impacted by the pandemic. So I think we are a very, very different economy.
Would you say that would set us back in terms like Israel might have a bit of a head start then?
Well, I think Israel has a head start because their vaccination program is going a lot faster than ours. But I think in general, we can expect, you know, if with the right public policies to make a full recovery, if a little bit slower than some other countries.
What does reopening an economy while keeping social distancing measures in place look like?
Well, I think we have seen what it looks like over the last summer and early fall before we had to tighten the restrictions again. And it looks different in different provinces. I mean, even right now, in different provinces are at different stages of their economy being open or closed. In BC, for example, we have very few restrictions on the operation of businesses compared to some places like Toronto, where almost everything is closed except for essential services.
Mm-hmm. So I guess it would look different across the country too, just depending on where the regions are at, right?
Yeah, you would have to. It really is a situation where public health is the most important consideration, and how we're doing in terms of curbing the spread of COVID-19 will affect our economy.
Is that something that countries like Canada could have as a disadvantage, just given that our healthcare is different from province to province, and therefore a lot of the response has varied?
I don't necessarily think it's the healthcare system that is the determining factor here. I think it really, we have seen during this pandemic that what matters in terms of the spread of the virus is how people live. So in most densely populated areas, there is more spread of the virus. When there's less population, you know, density, we have less. We also see that in communities with a lot of poverty and lower incomes and more racialized communities in Canada are suffering from that. There is higher rates of the virus because people live in crowded housing. They cannot isolate when they're sick, and they infect their community members a lot more easily.
Did any of Canada's pre-existing policies bring us any advantages or disadvantages going into the pandemic? For instance, our EI is clearly seen an upgrade since CERB, but if we had that, would that have maybe protected us a little bit more?
I think Canada did quite well in responding to the gaps in the policies which weren't serving us. I mean, obviously, you pointed employment insurance is one of the programs that, in the way it existed before the pandemic, was completely inadequate to meet the need. And so Canada invented a whole new program, the CERB, you know, Canada Emergency Response Benefit, in order to meet that need. And that happened very quickly. It really was an impressive achievement in terms of government stepping in and meeting the needs of the population in times that previously were inconceivable for designing new policies. So I think Canada really stepped up. And compared to a number of other countries, we have provided more supports for individuals and for businesses. And I think that has cushioned the impact on individuals and businesses here compared to what it has been in some other countries.
So you think that Canada, therefore, actually has a bit of a leg up going into reopening?
I think Canada could have suffered much more than it did. And I think it's really important to be mindful as we proceed towards reopening, how these programs are scaled down. Because if they are pulled out too quickly, I think we can suffer quite a bit. Because the reality is that a lot of businesses and a lot of households actually rely on these programs to make ends meet. And the only reason why they haven't declared bankruptcy is these programs. And if they get pulled away too quickly, I think we're going to see some huge problems.
Are there any policies that you think Canada should look at implementing, just given what we've learned going through the pandemic?
Yeah, for sure. I think we have learned a lot of things in the pandemic. And I think we really, for example, we have learned that we have much bigger problems with gender and racial injustices and inequalities than maybe a lot of people thought. And I think we need to address these issues as we move forward. I think we really have learned, for example, that unpaid caregiving, or, you know, the lack of childcare, and when schools were closed and childcares were closed, really were a huge barrier for women to be able to work. And we have learned that we need to provide much better childcare in this country. And I am optimistic that we're going to see some investments in the federal budget coming up in a couple of weeks. And I think we've also seen that a lot of the essential workers that we really need in order for our daily lives to be able to continue are actually living in poverty and don't have benefits like paid sick leave. And I think we need to consider what we're going to do. We saw during the height of the pandemic at the first, sort of the first initial stage with the first closures in March, grocery store workers, for example, were given some hazard pay temporarily. And I think we need to think about what the minimum wage needs to be so that essential workers don't actually have to live in poverty. So these are the kind of things that I think we need to be thinking about: paid sick leave, supports for workers. Also, The other important thing that we saw during the pandemic, actually, and not everywhere, but in BC specifically, there has been a freeze on rent or recognition that low-income tenants or other renters who have lost their jobs are finding it really hard to afford the very high costs of housing here in our province, and that we need to do something to limit the rise of rents. And so we need to see, I think, in going forward, much more supports for renters and especially low-income renters.
Are there any countries that are doing this right now that you could think of as an example that have proven to be successful and made the country more resilient?
Well, I think there's a lot of countries that have done quite a bit better on housing policy specifically, that have much more public housing, for example, and that don't have such huge gaps between the wages that people actually earn and the cost of housing, which I think Vancouver in particular and BC in general is one of the least affordable places in the world for housing compared to local wages. So I think we're in a very different position compared to many other countries.
If Canada is so much further behind on vaccinations than a lot of our allies and a lot of our close trading partners, for instance, America, the United Kingdom, do you think that maybe Canada could actually stand to lose anything or miss out as these countries kind of go full force in reopening their economy and we're still focused on vaccinating?
Well, I think we'll definitely be slower out of the gate of returning back to full, you know, economic activity. But I don't think, you know, we're talking about very long periods of time, given at least the current vaccination plans. You know, we're only talking about, a few months. So I don't think that's such a huge barrier in the long term. I think if we fail to invest in the kind of policies we need to set up for inclusive growth, I think we risk much more in the long term if we don't actually address the inequalities that we have seen emerge in this pandemic. I think we risk a lot more than having the vaccination be slowed by a couple of months compared to some of the countries. But I do think that it raises an important question of why does Canada not have domestic vaccine production capacity, and what we need to do in terms of strengthening some of those manufacturing, abilities or capacities in our country, because we have relied a lot on importing things, from other countries. We have relied too much on trade in the past and thought that we don't need to be able to have the capacity locally. We can just import it from somewhere else. But now we're seeing that at times of crisis, that actually doesn't happen. And we need to reconsider those supply chains and boost local manufacturing capacity in Canada.
And that would also increase job opportunities, right, for locals?
Oh, absolutely, it will. But more importantly, at times of crisis, and I don't think this pandemic will be the last crisis of this century,
no,
unfortunately, I think it will make us a lot more resilient in times of crisis. And that's really important. And even considering climate change, I mean, we're having some of these conversations around food security and, you know, how much of the food that we consume is actually produced in Canada, how much is imported from California.
Could this be a wake-up call for all countries, even when it comes to domestic production?
I hope so. I really think that we have learned that domestic production capacity is crucial in terms of being able to withstand crisis when trade routes are being disrupted.
Looking at Israel a bit again, it is going to be the first country to really, you know, get back onto their old playing field economically. And there's going to be a couple of countries that follow. We see the UAE, United Kingdom. Do you think that maybe that could actually pose as a little bit of a negative for them? They're going to be going a little bit of in trial and error, whereas Canada can sit back and watch what's successful and what's not successful?
Perhaps. I mean, I think there's always some risks in being the leaders, but there's a lot of opportunities as well. So I think it's more the other way around. Like, we can say the silver lining of Canada not being first out of the gate to vaccinate its population and recover is that we get to learn the lessons from other countries. But I think generally speaking, we are seeing that you know, different countries recover at a different rate. Again, in my view, the speed right now is not the crucial factor when you think about long-term growth. We're only talking about a few months, less than a year. I think, you know, what I am more concerned about, for example, is the fact that when we look globally at vaccination progress, we're seeing very little vaccines going to developing countries, going to South America or Africa, and some parts of Asia. And so I think that that will be more of a concern globally for the global economy being able to recover. Because if you think about trade or tourism, even if large parts of the world aren't vaccinated for years to come, we're not talking here about a couple of months, you know, or we're talking about years. And so what will this mean for the global economy?
I've seen a lot of research that kind of points to the idea that if we leave some of these areas in the world unvaccinated and we don't help out, that the virus could spread a lot. And when it comes uncontrolled, that's when variants often pop up. And when variants come, we don't necessarily know that the vaccines will protect against all of the variants that could come out of this. Therefore, it is important that the entire world focuses on making sure that the entire world is vaccinated, because really a wholly vaccinated country could be kind of set back at stage one if something were to happen. It really does seem to be a we're all in this together type thing.
It is. And not to mention the, you know, human rights dimensions or the fact that it is completely unjust to have large parts of the world where even the most vulnerable healthcare workers aren't able to be vaccinated before we vaccinated every last Canadian, even, you know, and how unfair that is. And it's partially, you know, due to intellectual property rights with this vaccine and of rich countries like Canada, buying up all the supply early on so that other countries can't get their hands on it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for this opportunity.
British Columbia has currently distributed about 364,000 doses. Provincial and federal officials are giving optimistic outlooks for the next few months as vaccine production ramps up. We'll continue to follow this story closely. And in today's Capital Daily News Review, the 2021 Greater Victoria flower count starts today. Residents are encouraged to count all the blossoms they see until March 10th. The annual tally has grown from 130 million in 1976 to 4 billion in 1996 and 25 billion in 2016. Although the growth likely reflects major increase in participation, not vegetation. Thank you so much for joining the podcast again today. If you enjoyed what you heard, please leave a review and rate. Also subscribe so that you never miss an episode. We post episodes from Monday to Friday. My name is Jackie Lamport. This is the Capital Daily Podcast. We'll talk to you tomorrow.